Hey guys, this week's episode is brought to you by Modsy. You send Modsy some photos of your room and they create two lifelike 3D designs of your space using real products from real stores that you can rearrange, switch out, even buy from right there. Check it out at modsy.com/YHL. That's modsy.com/YHL. And stay tuned for 20% off discount code. I'm John.
And I'm Sherry.
We like home stuff.
We like talking.
And we like the occasional game show sound effect. So welcome to Young House Love Has a Podcast, where we have deep and not so deep conversations about DIY, design, and life at home.
Today, we're talking to a real estate coach about the smartest ways to get into real estate investing. And you'll never guess what almost ruined our beach house floors or why John thinks the end of Fixer Upper might actually end up being a good thing. A few weeks ago, you might have seen on the blog that we got all of the pine floors refinished and they look so pretty. And going into this, we were like, this is going to be cake. Because you guys remember that a while back we shared how we refinished the floors in our own home. And that involves like moving all the furniture out.
That was not a piece of cake. We effectively moved out of our first floor for, 10 days, 12 days? I forget how long it was.
It was a while. And we like stayed with other people for some of the days. And we went on a little trip for some of the days. But we lived to tell the tale. And I think even in a recent episode, we were saying it's still so worth it. Like, don't not do your floors because it's one of the things that makes your house look so done and you'll be so happy with every room.
But it made me very excited for the beach house because
there's no furniture, guys.
We don't live there. Like, getting out of the way of the floor finisher was not a big deal at all. It's like we need to call the other contractors, tell them not to come in and, you know, try to finish their painting or whatever.
Right. The hardest part of it was me just orchestrating, like, no, you can't come in. Actually, I had the floor refinisher take the key. We have a block box in the back for contractors that they know the code and can walk in. If they use the code, they get the key. And there was no key in the box. So I thought, I'm so on top of this. Nobody can walk in while these floors are sealed and drying. But what we did not account for...
Yes, the person who thwarted our perfect planning...
was the mailman, because that's one of those doors that has an opening for the mail.
Yeah, it has like an old-timey mail slot in the front door, which we're not used to. We don't have here. We've never had one of those.
Right, and the funny thing is that we've set up mail forwarding. So like, we don't get mail at that house. Anything that we get gets forwarded to our house here in Richmond. And so I didn't think of it. I'm sure that the guy doing the floors could have taped it off or done something to prepare, but in my head, I wasn't like, mail's gonna come through because we don't get mail there. But I guess it all happened in slow motion as the floor refinisher has sealed his way out of the house. So he started at the front door, went all the way out to the back door, which is where everyone has a key, and locked the back door. He's walking around the front, and as he's walking around the front, he sees the mailman like let go of mail in his hand, and it's fallen to the floor in the house.
I picture it in like super slow motion, like no!
Exactly. Like
drunk house love, basically.
Drunk house love all over again. And so he calls me and he's like, you'll never believe this. You don't have a key to the front door here, do you? And I'm like, no, we've only ever kept a key to the back door in the lockbox. Because he's like, if I had a key to the front door, I could open the door and try to pluck the mail up.
So that would just be too logical.
Right. But he's like, what I can't do is walk through the entire house from the back door to try and get the mail up because I'll ruin the floor everywhere by doing that.
Long story short, guys, we have an imprint of 17 magazine.
We don't.
Right in the front of the house. No.
We do not. Thankfully, the floor is perfect. What he ended up doing is he came back in the morning. He was able to lift it up. He said he had to do some buffing, but it actually was not a big deal. But it just was funny to get this panicked call. Not funny at the time, funny in hindsight, that we thought of everything. We took the key away. Like, nobody could have done this damage but the mail.
Well, and I don't think you said, like, it wasn't our mail.
Yeah, that's the hilarity of the whole thing. It was the wrong person's mail.
Right. We have that forwarding. So he just put the mail in the wrong address slot.
Right. It was like mail for someone who lived like 7 houses away, not even really close. I'm not blaming the mailman. I'm sure these things happen all the time because it really wasn't anybody's fault. It was just like the universe playing a joke on us.
# mail slot problems. Well, and what's new with me this week is actually something on my mind. So I would like to roll the music for, can we just talk about... So this may come across as a controversial opinion.
You might scream and clutch your chest.
You might. But I would like to talk about the end of Fixer Upper and how I think there is actually a great silver lining to that show coming to an end. I know, cue the gasps. I think they have ushered in a lot of great things for HGTV.
They have like the best personalities of anyone who's ever been on Design TV, I believe.
Yes, I think hands down. But I think at the same time, their popularity has also locked HGTV into a certain kind of like married duo real estate renovation formula that personally for me is growing a little bit tired. And so I feel like maybe it's a good thing that they are moving on to other things. I mean, I certainly don't think we are going to have a shortage of Chip and JoJo in our lives moving forward.
My prediction is they're going to have another show on a different network.
I wouldn't be surprised at that at all. But I think this might shake HGTV up a little bit and maybe get us some new variety in their programming. Because I will not claim to be a scholar of HGTV, but from...
I feel like you might have like an 8-year doctorate.
No.
Like we've watched that channel forever.
Well, but I feel like we dip in and out because it does kind of go through these cycles of like the type of programming. And honestly, like one thing I love about HGTV sometimes is that it is so... kind of steady that you can just like lay down on the couch and turn it on and know what you're going to get.
Right. Like at 2:45, you can get into the end of some reveal of a makeover and then just keep going. It's a marathon.
Yep.
You can watch it all day.
I had a stomach bug the other day. Just lay down and watch Desert Flippers. I had never seen the show before, but I was like, the desert sounds fun.
Now you'll always associate that show with a stomach bug.
I think if you look back, HGTV had their like single host plus sidekick formula for a while, you know, when it was like the Candace Olsons and the Angelo Sermolises.
Oh yeah, I remember him. What about David Bromstad? Yeah. Who else was around that era?
David Bromstad's still around, but it's, you know, like a single person and then like the carpenter or the assistant or whatever. I mean,
remember Clive Pierce? Clive Pierce.
Well, that's when they just had a host. He wasn't even a designer.
He was the best. I mean, still love him.
Even Emily Henderson and Orlando Soria on her show, like, that was that era of host and sidekick.
Right.
And then I think maybe the Property Brothers started us into this like duo stage.
You're probably right. It probably was them.
Yeah. Like suddenly, we have people who are related who kind of have equal standing on the show.
Like, then they were like kitchen cousins.
Kitchen cousins, listed sisters.
Like, oh my gosh, you're right.
Like, and I think it was Chip and Joanna that finally really broke into the married couple era.
And as we said, they're like the cutest and have the best banter and Chip's so funny and Joanna's so like aspirational. Like they had so much going for them that women want to be her and like they laugh at Chip and he's so silly, but he loves her and like they're the perfect dynamic for TV.
Obviously, we're not ones to knock like a husband and wife duo doing this thing because hello. But I think that's how we have Flipper Flop, and we have Flipper Flop every city in the United States, it feels like now. And it seems like almost every show that's coming out is this pairing of husband and wife. But I feel like maybe this is the moment HGTV could seize to just try some different things. Like, I'm actually really excited that Trading Spaces is coming back. I know that's not on HGTV, but I feel like that was kind of a different gimmick, a different way to consume Design TV, and maybe that will inject some life
a little
bit.
It's not just host, sidekick, or siblings, or
mother-daughter.
Yeah, I like the mother-daughter show, though.
I really like Good Bones, and I think part of it is because it's a different relationship dynamic.
Yeah, if you guys aren't watching Good Bones, it's a good one to check out, because the mom and the daughter are both really handy, their brothers are involved, they buy these real beater houses, which I love, they remind me of the beach house.
I think they're in Indianapolis. So I think there's a lot of good shows in there. I'm not saying they need to ditch everything.
Well, they're listening, John, and they're going to do everything you say.
I'm sure. This is their single-person focus group right now. I'm just saying I'm trying to find the silver lining in Fixer Upper coming to an end. I think it probably does mean good things for Chip and Joanna going forward because I think they probably were outgrowing HGTV a little bit. I don't know if that's part of the decision. I know there's so many rumors about why they did it. But I think they've got so much going. Like, we're going to have plenty of them in our lives, just in a different way. And maybe, guys, maybe that's a good thing.
And also, before you all email and say, like, why don't you guys have a show? We get emails like that or comments like that a lot. We actually, for the entire time we've been blogging, have been nervous about TV. And it doesn't sound relaxing to us. So I just think it's not our cup of tea. Like, the idea of someone following me around with a camera makes my armpits just, like, release the Kraken. Something happens that the sweat just starts dripping down my body. It just doesn't sound like a fun thing for us.
Plus, we would just fall into that formula.
Right. It'd be like, hi, we're married.
Right, exactly. I'm a realtor. She's a contractor.
Oh, no, we're over budget. I have to call a homeowner and see if we can squeeze $5,000 out of them to fix this header beam that is giving us trouble.
See, you'd be terrible.
I'd be terrible. See that? Guys, that was my audition tape.
My favorite thing I've noticed if you watch like the House Hunter shows is they say, let's go or let's check it out all the time.
This kitchen needs a lot of help, but let's go look at the bedrooms.
Okay, let's go.
So for this week's game, I'm actually going to quiz John because I saw Benjamin Moore's Color of the Year. And then I said, John, I saw it. I would like for you to avoid the news if you can so that I can quiz you.
I was sequestered.
I sent him off to live on a farm. That right. Sounds bad. Like, you're never coming back.
Daddy went to live on a farm, guys.
Daddy will be back after I can quiz him about the color right. of the year. This is perfectly normal behavior.
Right, exactly. I will say that I got a couple of hints or clues because there were some commenters on Instagram.
Spoilers.
They did not get me to the answer. Like, I still don't know what it is, but I wanted to be upfront that I have a little bit of guiding information.
Well, what were those?
Well, one, I stopped reading as soon as I saw the words color of the year, so I don't know what it said.
So that's
except,
not a hint.
Except that you were not correct, I think.
Uh-huh.
And I think your greens maybe is the guess you had made. I don't even remember.
My guess was a really, really, really soft pink.
Oh, okay. So I think someone said that wasn't correct. And then,
and do you remember my guess for Pantone?
Pantone was something bold like yellow or orange.
Or?
Purple? I don't remember.
Okay, never mind.
I don't really listen to this podcast. And I saw one other one that said Benjamin Moore went big or bold this year.
That is true. So, guys, I couldn't have been more wrong.
So I was thinking before I saw that maybe they had landed in the kind of like army green zone because that's what I was thinking.
That's your initial guess?
That doesn't feel very bold, though, because they did shadow last year, which was kind of a deep color. I'm going to say they went for a corally orange.
Close, but no cigar. The color is called Caliente.
Oh.
The funniest thing, too, is that it's an affinity color. And anyone who knows Benjamin Moore, like I know Benjamin Moore, which is a deep, meaningful relationship, the affinity colors have the letters AF after them. And so I think that's hilarious because it'll be like Tranquility AF.
Right.
Which, like, for anyone who knows what the youth are saying.
Yeah, for all the cool kids out there. This color is Caliente AF.
So this always makes me laugh. So anyway, they describe Caliente AF, which is like a bold red.
Yeah.
It's like a fire engine red with a little bit of orange.
So you spicy hot.
Super off. Yeah, it's described as hot, passionate, and sexy. This is one of our most beloved reds with a hint of orange. Caliente has lots of personality and is the perfect hue if you're drawn to the warmer tones of red. The funny thing is, I wish you had remembered what I guessed for Pantone, because guys, do you remember I said Pantone does a bolder thing, they make a statement, and I had said, it was a throwaway line, but at the very end I said, either yellow or a poppy red color. I think I said a poppy watermelon red.
So you were wrong, basically.
I was wrong, but this is a bright red like that, so it's similar.
Well, your move, Pantone.
Why is nobody doing that light blush color?
I think maybe because it's
because millennial pink happened?
It's sort of already permeated our culture, so you're just confirming what already is.
I think you're picturing millennial pink, though, and mine is the blushest, lightest, softest, like tan with a little hint of blush.
Yeah, it's still not interesting enough.
Okay.
We'll see. Well, next up, we are going to give a ring to Dana Bull. She is actually someone who calls herself a real estate coach, and she lives in the Boston area and also does a lot of real estate investing. And so we were really curious to talk to her now that we've got another property to work on in Cape Charles to see if she can make us feel a little less crazy about having made this decision to dive into another house.
Still kind of nervous, guys. Yep, what did we do?
Still haven't done anything to it, so.
Right, it's just sitting there.
So let's give Dana a ring.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Dana, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
We are great. We're excited to talk to you.
I know, this is amazing. My PR lady, Kristen, is so excited, as is my mom. Oh. She listens to your podcast, so I was telling her yesterday about it, and she's like, wait, what?
Shout out to Dana's mom.
So we recently actually had a money coach on the podcast, and I see that you call yourself a real estate coach. And so I was curious sort of what that is. Like, is that different than a realtor?
So I'm also a realtor, but what I figured out quickly is that there's definitely a demand for going above and beyond the real estate agent function of going and showing houses. And it's more about the high level, the financials, the loan programs, the investing strategies, all that kind of stuff under one umbrella. So that's what I've started to carve out as a niche.
And you personally started investing really young, right? Tell us a little bit of your backstory of how you got into this.
Yeah. So I started pretty much right out of college, about 9 months after I graduated. And it was the tail end of the recession at that time. I was trying to actually rent an apartment. And I figured out that my monthly payment on something I were to purchase would actually be about $400 a month less. So that's what started my wheels turning. from there, it kind of dovetailed. And my boyfriend, he's now my husband, but we started accumulating more properties.
And maybe this is too forward of me, but are we able to ask how old you are now?
Yeah. So I'll be 29 in April. So 28.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. When you said you were graduating and it was the tail end of the recession, I mouthed to John, she's younger than us.
Yes. I did. Most of my tenants are older than me.
You're just so awesome. Smart. So you were 22 when you got into this.
Yes.
Well, Sherry and I are knocking on 36's door.
Speak for yourself. I am thoroughly 35.
Well, and we're just sort of getting our feet wet in the sort of second property arena. We bought a fixer-upper beach house that is going to be a vacation home for ourselves, but also a vacation rental. And then we just shared recently with our listeners that we bought a second beach property, actually two doors down from our first one, that's also going to be a vacation rental. So we are babies at this whole sort of investing thing.
I think I'd trade for the vacation homes.
Well, you wouldn't trade for them right now because they're not done. They're in an interesting state. So I'm really curious to talk to you about sort of the, I guess, maybe entry level for anyone else out there who has been dreaming about maybe getting a second property down the road, sort of like what you can teach us about how to do that in a smart way.
So have you guys heard of the concept of house hacking?
We know nothing about this. Treat us like novices.
I had been doing this for a long time, but I didn't know that it was called something. And the idea is basically you live in the property and you somehow are able to collect rent on it. So for instance, you buy a 2-bedroom condo and you rent out one of the bedrooms to your friends. Or you buy a multifamily house and you live in one of the units and you rent out the other one or two. So the concept is it's almost like investing, but with training wheels. So you're living on site, so you're able to keep tabs on what's going on. But what this allows you to do from a lending standpoint is you can actually be able to take advantage of certain loans, products, and programs that the banks offer for owner occupants. But it's this whole concept of house hacking, and it's how a lot of people get started with this.
Well, and like you said, it also gives you the place to live. You don't have to actually technically own any other property.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right there on premises. And so it might make that landlord aspect of it a little bit easier because you can identify problems and be there to fix them. You're not being like called across town in the middle of the night.
Right. And the other thing is that's always everybody's big fear.
It's mine.
Yeah. You know what? I've been doing this for 7 years. I have never had a midnight call.
Really?
Knock on wood.
People like to paint this picture that like your time is never your own because someone at any point in the middle of your child's graduation could call you and say, there's a leak.
Yeah. I mean, but look, I'm not a parent, but you two are. You already feel that way, right?
That is true.
And yeah, I definitely get calls and sometimes there's never a good time to get a call. You build up your team and most, I would say, the majority of the calls that I get are plumbing related and I have a fantastic relationship with a 24/7 plumbing company. So anytime there's a leak, I just say, guys, here's the number. You know what to do. Call the plumber. They'll send me the bill. Let's not worry about it. But most of my tenants, like they're not up in the middle of the night. So nothing's really breaking, right?
Well, we were talking to a neighbor who's a realtor and she also owns some investment properties. She was saying like she just uses a management company. She's figured out a way to make that make sense for a lot of financial sense, that is, for a lot of her second properties. And so she's just like, I just get a check in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
I'm completely hands off.
Yeah, it sounds like you don't do the management company. Is it just to save the income that you would spend towards them managing it?
So there's a few reasons. I don't hate being a landlord. I actually view it as a really incredible learning opportunity. I chose not to go back to school. I chose to invest that money that I would have spent on schooling and put it into properties. And, you know, the idea is that I could actually stop working now if I wanted to. But I'm not going to because I really like the work that I do.
29, retired, mic drop.
almost. I mean, I don't pay housing expenses. That's huge. I used to spend $36,000 a year on rent. But, you know, like every month at this point, I have some major expense, whether it's I have to replace a boiler or I have to rebuild the chimney, but it doesn't hurt anymore because when you have enough places in your portfolio, you can support that. When you're first starting out, it's hard. You feel each expense going out like a loss.
That leads me to the question of like for someone else out there who's thinking about taking this step, how would you coach someone on knowing that they're like either financially or, you know, mentally ready to take the leap?
You kind of nailed it on the head, John, with it's part financial and part emotional. But I would say even the emotional stuff, for the most part, that's still tied to the financial side of things, right? Because we're held back by the fear of what if we can't make ends meet? What if the market crashes? You know, of course, there's the commitment stuff that comes along with homeownership. Am I ready? But if you're 30 years old, successful at work, I'm sure you can handle home ownership. It's more that nagging fear of what if something breaks and I can't afford it. So I would direct it back to the financial side of things. And each person has to figure that out for themselves. So what I would do is first off, start with your overall goals. So if you're 26 and you want to buy a house, but you're also trying to pay off student loan debt, perhaps trying to save for a wedding, you really need to prioritize those things and put together like a 5 or 8 year plan about how you're going to pay for all those things with the income that you have. Once you step out and you stop looking at the home purchase in a vacuum, but really as part of the bigger picture, things will become more clear. Then you definitely want to get a lender into the equation as soon as possible, because they can help clarify what your monthly payment's going to be, what your closing costs are going to be, so that you're working with real numbers. But ultimately, the bank, the lender, they can't tell you what you can afford. They might say, you can afford a $300,000 house, but after you figure out, well, this is what we need for the wedding, this is what we need for savings, this is what we need for paying off our debt, we can only afford $150,000. And then you at least know what you're working with.
So let's say someone figures out that they are in a good financial spot, a good emotional spot. What would you advise them in terms of how to look for the right property?
What you want to do is you want to start by putting yourself in the end user, the end consumer's shoes. So if you're looking for a property to flip, you want to think like a buyer, because eventually that's your market. If you're buying a property to rent, you want to think like a renter. So the first thing that you want to do is get educated on the market that you're in and take a look at the inventory of what's moving. So if you're buying a flip a house, what are the flip properties going for? What do they look like? What kind of finishes do they have? Alternatively, if you're buying a rental, what's the expectation from the renters in your market? So here in Boston, my rentals that are downtown, my tenants, they expect granite, they expect stainless, which is very different from my rentals, you know, 30 minutes north of the city, where they're fine with formica, they're fine with vinyl flooring. So once you have that arsenal of information, when you're going out into the market and actually looking at properties, you want to start to think about how much money do I need to spend? What do I need to do to this property to get it to the end goal? So usually I recommend buying something that's structurally sound. Most of the bigger ticket items have been taken care of, but it's cosmetically outdated. So it's kind of like going and buying your grandmother's two family.
Is there any red flag that you look for when you're checking out a potential buy, like that is just, you know, a total deal killer for you?
For me, I've only walked away from one property, and it was because we found this hidden room where the tenants were practicing Santeria, which is where they sacrifice animals.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was a very, very clean room because that was part of the ceremony.
I guess that's a plus.
But I walked away from that deal because I was like, nope, not doing it.
Yeah, that house has some interesting juju, I think.
So I walk away from legality issues. So I've seen 2-unit buildings and they've built out the attic. Somebody is living in the attic. They've built out the basement. Somebody's living in the basement. So now they have it functioning as a 4-unit, except the city only approves it as a 2-unit. So now you have a legal issue. But I say it's all about buying smart. And what that means is minimizing risk. So I regularly have buyers reach out to me and they say, Dana, I found this, this $250,000 condo. What do you think? And it sounds too good to be true. And it is. The reason is usually it's below grade. So the unit is in a basement. And yeah, I get it. That's really affordable. But is that really the best investment that you can make? I'm not saying it's a bad buy. I'm just saying that it limits your options, which in my view is risky. So for resale, who's the next buyer? If the market isn't so hot, is there going to be a next buyer? Since it's such a small floor plan, can you unlock any value? And again, it's below grade. It's always going to be below grade. You can't change that.
And when you say unlock value, why don't you describe that for us a little bit? Because I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So there's kind of going back to buying your grandmother's place. I love those properties where there's pride of ownership, but things are just tired. Are there hardwood floors? Are there hardwood wood floors under the rugs? Can you replace countertops? Are the cabinets good? Can you paint the cabinets? what would the buyers expect? And could you affordably turn the place you're thinking about buying into that? The other thing that's really tricky is, and I struggle with this because I am proud of my properties and I want them to look good. And that's not my investment mind speaking. That's just me speaking. It's like over-improving.
Yeah, we have this struggle too.
Right? And you got to reel it in because it's hard to make some of those design choices because I'm always that one where it's like, well, that light fixture is only $10 more and I like it so much better. But yeah, it's $10 more times 20 light fixtures. And especially for you guys where it's your business, you know, it's your brand as well wrapped into this. So you do need to be mindful of that in a way that the average investor, small mom and pop investor doesn't need to.
Yeah, it is a challenging nut to crack.
I think what would be nice about it for everything, for the blog and for the investment, is if we can be really smart, like you were saying, and find an inexpensive material, but maybe lay the tile in a cool way.
Yeah, I do that kind of stuff all the time. When I did one of my rentals, I went with carpenter grade oak. So like the cheapest oak floors that you can get. And then what I did was to separate out the different rooms, I put a dark piece of pine.
Ooh.
So it kind of like gives that extra little something with the pine that's staying dark, separating out and defining the spaces. But then the rest of the floor is cheap.
Oh, yeah. It looks like expensive inlay, but you didn't pay for expensive inlay.
Oh, yeah. We just bought a cheap piece of pine.
Well, it was so good talking to you, Dana.
Ditto. I was kind of nervous, but this was like, you guys are so easy to talk to.
Oh, you too.
Bye.
If you guys want to learn more about Dana Bull and even check out her real estate coaching services, we'll put the link to her website in the show notes at younghouselove.com/podcast. There, we'll also put some links to some of Dana's favorite resources to sort of learn about real estate investing and, you know, figuring out whether you are financially and emotionally stable enough to dive into it.
Crazy enough.
Crazy enough, whatever it is.
Hey, if you can retire at 30, it might be worth looking into.
Totally. And oh, for my We're Digging this week, I'm going to get a little dirty.
Whoa.
But first, let's take a quick break.
Okay, so if you guys are stuck with how a room is coming together, you're having problems with the design, listen up, because this week's sponsor, Modzy.com, is totally here to help you guys.
Yeah, so you send Modzy some photos of your space, and they create this super lifelike 3D rendering of your space.
Not one, but two. They do it two different ways, so you can choose the one you like better, you can switch furniture out.
And it's all stuff from real stores, so you can go out and buy it, which is one of the main things that founder Shauna Tellerman really wanted to do with Modzy.
Scale is super important when designing a space, and understanding how they look next to each other, up against each other, is really kind of the key to making a decision. And I felt like that was a lot of what was blocking me from designing our home, was really trying to understand, how does this particular product fit into this particular spot? And then how does it look with the other product that I'm considering buying as well?
To see how it all works, just head over to modzy.com/YHL, where they've actually taken one of our most challenging rooms, our upstairs bonus room, and they reimagined it as a swanky master bedroom, just so you guys can see what they're capable of doing.
Yeah, so check that out at modzy.com/YHL. That's modsy.com/YHL. And use code YHL20 for 20% off your first room.
I know you guys are all wondering why John is dirty, but I'm going to take over first because I'm digging something that sort of came from an unexpected place. So I found some awesome kids bedding at HomeGoods, which is not at all what I think about when I go to HomeGoods. I love pillows and like tabletop decorative.
Cat trees.
Yeah, they have good rugs. I don't know. I don't think I've ever bought a comforter or a duvet or something there. That's like an aisle I don't even really walk up and down.
Yeah, you're usually like looking at the giant like mirrored horses.
Right, exactly. The like disco balls of all sizes. You can find some really funny quirky things at HomeGoods. But I think I just, for the beach house, have been drawn to these aisles of bedding and linens because I think in our house we're pretty much set. So I'm walking down the aisle thinking, ooh, is there good bedding for the beach house? I'm sure it would be inexpensive here. And I ended up finding this really sweet little comforter, and it's reversible. So like the top of it has a pink pattern and the bottom of it has a purple pattern, and it has little pom-pom trim all the way around it. And it's sort of, I wouldn't say batik, but it has sort of a Moroccan feeling to it.
It certainly is very intricate like that.
I mean, really, really beautiful looking, but inexpensive. I think it was a king-sized comforter. I grabbed it because my big quick tip, guys, is if you have a queen-sized bed, you want a king-sized bedding.
The comforter or the duvet, not the sheets, obviously.
Right. You want the sheets to fit the bed, but whenever you buy a comforter, oftentimes if you buy a full-size comforter for a full-size bed, you see like the mattress. You really want your bedding to be bigger than that. So I always size up. So I thought, I'm getting three queen beds for the beach house. The king comforter will be great. And it was super on sale. I think it might have been $39, which you can't beat
that. Yeah, that's a great deal for a king.
So I bought it and I brought it home, and I've been putting everything in the guest room that I'm saving for the beach house. And as I'm walking by our daughter's room, I'm like, hold the phone. This would be very cute in her room. And she's had the same sort of white bedding, I don't know, for the past like four or five years.
She upgraded to a big girl bed, she's had.
Right. And she's seven now. So like, it's been a while. And I love white bedding for kids, but I do sometimes feel like you can do white bedding in the guest room. You can do it in your room. You don't have to do it in a kid's room. You could do something fun in a kid's room. So my like brain was like, I know it's king size and her bed's a full, so it might be too big, but let's just like unwrap it and try it. And if not, we'll use it at the beach house. And we rolled it out in there, and it's beautiful. It's so fun to have that pop of color. It immediately feels more playful. She loved it. It's easy to keep clean because there's a pattern in color. Not that white was hard, but it just like is very, very forgiving of a pattern. And then I learned that, you know, my girl Sabrina Soto, we're down. We're home girls. I love her the most. And she has this new line at Bed Bath & Beyond of kids bedding, and it's called Casa & Co. And it's super adorable. There's cute sheets. There's awesome comforters. I would never think, even though the name is Bed Bath & Beyond, I would never think of kids bedding there. I don't know why. I think when I think of kids bedding, I go to like Pottery Barn Kids.
Right. Or Target.
Exactly.
I mean, I think because Bed Bath & Beyond to me is always like the staples. Like they have such a wide range.
That's where I go to get like the mattress pad.
Right.
But anyway, Sabrina's new line is so pretty, you guys. And I know she's my friend, but seriously, I'm not just saying that it's pretty. There's this comforter. It's like purple and pink flowers. That sounds garish, but it's the softest, most muted. Like, I would believe this was a super, super high-end Serena and Lily fabric. Like, it's just lovely. And it got me thinking about how it's really fun to choose something that's a little bit more, I don't know, patterned.
Playful.
Colorful.
Yeah. Youthful.
Happy. And it's your chance, right? Like, because most of us in our bedroom, we have a solid pattern duvet. You know, like, it's really fun to have some fun in there. The
little Sherry does not let me put Superman sheets on our bed.
I don't know. I might let you. I don't really care that much. Anyway, so I'm going to link a bunch of these in the show notes and maybe even make a mood board, because I think we all know we can go to Land of Nod, Target. Now I like the challenge of finding it in these unusual places. So I'll see what I can dig up.
Well, for my we're digging, I'm digging a John. Specifically, a Dirty John.
Oh, now I get it. Derp.
Yep. Which is a podcast that is not about me.
I know. I'm like, darn, we should have named our podcast Dirty John. It's just so catchy.
Right. Exactly. It just implies so many nice things about me. No, this is a podcast that is put out by the LA Times. So it's kind of almost in that true crimey vein.
It is. It's very, if you like Serial, you will like this podcast.
Yeah.
It opens on somebody's been stabbed. Can I give that much away? It's in the first minute.
Well, we have not actually finished it. It's six parts and we're just in part five. So
we still don't even know who got stabbed.
We don't know what has happened, but it weaves this tale of this gentleman named John, who is basically a con man.
He's very used car salesman to me. He's very slippery.
Yeah, they paint a very interesting picture of this guy. And so,
no offense to used car salesmen out there. I just realized that sounds so mean. You know, like the character who's very like, oh, baby, I just want to marry you after I met you for one day because I want you for your money. That kind of a character.
Right. That kind of used car salesman.
Not to imply that all used car salesmen are like that.
So I don't want to say much more because I think it will start to give it away, but it really tells an interesting tale of how this woman, all these women before her, were kind of swindled by this guy. And I mean, it's actually terrifying kind of listening to it. And
it reminds me of like people I know where I'm like, did you do a background check on that guy?
And it takes place in just like 2015 and 2016. So it's like very recent that this all happened. Maybe everyone out in LA already knows the story, but it was all new to me.
Yeah, it's super intriguing. And I think if anyone loves the true crime and the reveals, like every episode at the end, you want to start the next episode right away because you need to know what's
happening. Yeah, Sherry and I were binging it on the way to the beach house and back, and we didn't get to finish. And we're like, we should probably just sit down and listen to the end because I need to know how it ends. So it's six parts. Each episode is about 45 minutes, I think. Again, it's called Dirty John, not about me.
Different John.
Different Dirty John.
You're also Dirty John, but in like more of the, I just worked on the irrigation exactly. for the 10th time.
More like a grimy John.
Thanks for listening to Young House Love Has a Podcast.
And guys, there's only about a week left of Aquatober, you know, that month where I only drink water to kind of kick my soda habit. Hasn't always been easy, but if you're doing it with me this year, virtual high five, we're almost there.
And keep telling us what you do while you listen, like Rachel C. on Instagram, who listened on her way home from her 76th Hanson concert, as in 7-6. 76 Hanson concerts.
That is a lot of mbop.
And don't forget to check out younghouselove.com/podcast for all the bonus links, photos, and info from this episode.
Yeah, like some of Dana's favorite resources for all you future real estate moguls out there.
And that cute kids bedding I'm loving.
Later.
Bye. Mbop.
Every time you say white bedding, I get that Billy Idol song stuck in my head. I'm like, it's a nice day for a white bedding. Did we start again?
Did we just harmonize?
I don't know. Did we?
I don't think we did.
Me.
Guys, there's a reason we're not wedding singers. You just heard it.
Or bedding singers.